evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, January 4th, 2019. The South Sudanese ambassador to Sudan says four South Sudanese were killed in the protests.
Fortunately, we have lost four people in this demonstration in South Sudanese, two female and two male.
And a relative of South Sudanese who disappeared in Nairobi says the first vice president is responsible.
Dong is missing since 2017, together with a colleague, Mr. Agris Bon. A lot has been done through international organizations and through individuals' efforts, but something is missing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. At least four South Sudanese nationals have been killed during the ongoing protests in Sudan, according to South Sudan's embassy in Khartoum. In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, South Sudan's ambassador to Khartoum said the deceased were not taking part in those demonstrations. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
South Sudan ambassador to Khartoum, Mayan Dudwal, says two men and two women were killed in the capital Khartoum during ongoing demonstrations. Ambassador Dud says the four South Sudanese nationals were caught in the fire last week between Sudanese security forces and the demonstrators. But he says, according to reports from the verification committee, a panel set up by South Sudan embassy to monitor the protest, the four South Sudanese who were shot and killed were not taking part in any demonstrations.
Very unfortunate, we have lost four people in this demonstration in South Sudanese, two female and two male. They were not participating, but due to this, sometime the bullet can just cross and then go ahead you somewhere. So this is what we have now in this crisis that has taken place in Sudan.
Ambassador Dud says the committee formed by the embassy is tasked with monitoring the situation of South Sudanese nationals across Sudan, including those in the refugee camps. He says the committee shall also urge South Sudanese nationals not to take side in the ongoing riot in Sudan.
This committee is to move to see where our people are, because here, particularly in Khartoum State, we have about 30 camps where our people are living. So this committee, they are responsible to make coordinations with the leaderships of each camp so that to give them the full report, what is the situation in all this.
South Sudanese national Luca Lawrence Ndenge, who resides in Haj Yusuf of Eastern Nile in Khartoum, says he worries about his family's safety. Ndenge says the South Sudan embassy should provide them with security if the situation continues to worsen.
In any place, people will have to worry about it. It's something natural. Even myself, I'm worrying about the situation because I don't know what is going to happen tomorrow, next tomorrow. And from time to time, things are not going anyway.
Ndenge urged his fellow South Sudanese not to move about in Khartoum and other cities where protests are occurring unless absolutely necessary, and to avoid crowds associated with the ongoing unrest in Sudan. Dud says the unrest requires a collective effort from Sudanese leaders to find a peaceful way to resolve this crisis.
When there is no strong central power or government in the center that is providing security and protecting the citizen, I'm quite sure there will be an anarchy and crisis in the country. So I'm now cautioning and backing our Sudanese brother, whether in oppositions and government, to sit down and to solve their problem in a peaceful manner that will not let the country to lose its control.
Amnesty International has reported that at least 37 people have been killed by Sudanese authorities during 2 weeks of protest. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
Security forces fired tear gas at demonstrators in a Sudanese coastal city yesterday as thousands gathered to demand the resignation of Sudan President Omar al-Bashir. 22 trade unions and political parties called for more protests against Bashir and his government today, as we hear from Edward.
Amateur video posted on Twitter showed large crowds of demonstrators in the streets of Port Sudan Thursday chanting slogans against President Bashir and his government. Witnesses said security forces fired tear gas at protesters to try and disperse them. A number of top opposition political figures, including former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi, who was ousted by Bashir in a military coup nearly 30 years ago, have been calling on the president to step down. The country's top professional unions, including doctors, lawyers, teachers, engineers, and journalists, have called for a nationwide strike on Friday. Popular social media sites remain blocked, although some users appear to be accessing them via virtual private networks. In a nationally televised address Thursday, Bashir defended his record as president, saying that the country's economic crisis was not his fault and that the situation will improve slowly. He says that Sudan has been under an economic blockade for 21 years and that it is at the top of a list of countries which support terrorism, despite the fact, he claims, that not a single act of terrorism has been registered. No other developing country, he insists, has been under a blockade for so long. Turkey, he says, went into an economic tailspin after just a short period of tension with the United States. Bashir said he empathized with those who were suffering economically and that he was doing everything possible to improve the situation, including by raising the minimum wage, effective this month. Miriam Sadiq, the deputy head of the country's largest opposition party, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that President Bashir delivered an emotion-filled speech designed to sway the masses and convince them that he is doing something to resolve the crisis. But she added, the government is still torturing and killing people, and anarchy is spilling into the streets. Hasbullah Saleh, a member of Bashir's ruling party, defended the president, claiming that the economic situation is about to get better. He says that the government is preparing deep economic reforms and that gasoline is available again. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The family of a South Sudanese activist, Samuel Dong, who disappeared from Nairobi in 2017 at the hands of unknown security operatives, is accusing South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai, of being responsible for the disappearance of Dong and Agri Idri. Pulit Gokwar, a relative of Dong, says Taban Deng's silence on Dong's disappearance is suspicious. He says the vice president once threatened Dong to stop criticizing the SPLM-IO Taban faction.
I have what I know that I will share with you. Dong is missing since 2017, together with a colleague, Mr. Agri's born. A lot has been done through international organizations and through individuals' efforts. But something is missing, of which I'm concerned that it should be spoken out. The government is in Juba under the leadership of President Salva Kiir. Is responsible, though there are so many allegations that the Kenyan government has been involved. But the most important thing is the Juba government is responsible.
How are they responsible? These people were picked from Nairobi.
These people were picked in Nairobi, yes. This is a clear fact. But these are not any casual individual, just like me and any other youth like myself. These are high-profile ranking individuals in the society. They cannot just disappear in a big city. Accusations have been made against the first vice president, Taban Dengai.
Who made those accusations?
If I'm to remind you, the information minister, Mr. Makweliet, said that IO leadership in Juba is fully responsible for this. And IO leadership is headed by Mr. Taban. Mr. Taban never came out publicly to defend himself. That draws a conclusion, because even in law, we can understand. This is not economic crime or some small crime like a tort. This is a criminal offense. And if you keep quiet for such a longer time, you are accepting responsibility to what you have been accused of.
So you are telling me that the silence of first vice president Taban Dengai is accepting responsibility? Is that what you're saying?
There's more to that, yes. There's more to that. is not only the silence, but if we are to trace back to the activities that he did, because I remember he was in communication with Dong.
Who was communicating with Dong?
Taban, before Dong.
How did you know? What proof do you have?
The proof I have is I've grown up with Dong for a very long time, and I became almost personal assistant to him. We share a lot. Not only that, there's an evidence on Facebook where he wrote he was threatened by Mr. Taban, warning him to stop whatever is critiquing against the government. So that is...
So you are telling me that the first vice president warned Samuel Dong. Is there any proof that you have that you can show it to me?
There's a proof because Dong is someone that his character is respected by so many. There's no way Dong can just post something that a 10-year-old child can do, like he did by writing on Facebook that he was threatened by Taban. These are facts that we all know. Taban was in communication with Dong, and Dong disappeared in the hands of Taban.
I mean, in South Sudan, you don't just come from nowhere. You come from a community.
Yes.
What is the community of Samuel Dong saying at this time?
The community is concerned as a family. The family of Dong seem to be divided because we have a minister, Mr. Riegai Kok, which is the same Luakog of Dong, the same Kok. But he has not done anything himself. We don't know his position. There's no communication between us and him whatsoever. The community has the law. I've not received any official communication on their stand, on Dong, as their son. But as a family, a lot of people are concerned. Even where in the U.S., we have some relatives that are concerned about Dong. They share the same feelings. Okay, a lot of people share the same feelings, but at least when we communicate, we get each other's stand, yes.
And what is the stand? Talk to me more of how the family is feeling, because for 1 year and some months you have not seen your loved one, it's not easy. What are the feelings?
Well, our feelings is equally the same to those whose loved ones are in the same situation we are in. On the basis of human feelings, we are in that feeling that you cannot describe, but you just know that you are in a bad situation. I found myself responsible for the children of my brother who educated me. I was not prepared to take any responsibility handling a house with young children. I'm a child on my own rights. I'm in college. There are so many things that I've given up to do what is beyond my capacity. So that feeling, if I'm to tell you, I was in hospital twice for fatigue, you see.
That's Polet Gakawor, a relative of Samuel Dong, who disappeared from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, in January of 2017. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Nairobi this past hour. In part two of our interview next week, War talks about how the family of Samuel Dong struggles with life in Nairobi. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new wrinkle is added to the DRC's efforts to control Ebola. That story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
when you are upset, would you rather be alone or with others?
I'd rather be alone, because sometimes being with people demands a lot from someone's self.
When you stress up, there's no need of being alone, because when you are with others, at least they can advise you.
When I'm upset, actually, being alone is not a good thing. So at least I have to associate with my colleague, and I end up releasing that anger from me.
I prefer being alone when I'm upset, yeah, because at least when I'm alone, I regain some humor that I, when at least I go in public, I can talk with someone now. But when I'm still pissed, I can't talk to anyone.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. The Democratic Republic of Congo's presidential election has added a new complexity to the effort to control Ebola and its outbreak in the country's east. The area has been a conflict zone for more than two decades now and is an opposition stronghold with a strong mistrust of the central government. That and long-held traditions have translated into community resistance to the international effort to fight Ebola. There have been more than 600 confirmed and suspected cases of the deadly virus, making it the worst outbreak since the West Africa epidemic that killed more than 11,000 people from 2014 to 2016. Election violence has further hampered the Ebola fight. J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies tells my colleague Paul Alexander about the best and worst case scenarios for the Ebola outbreak.
We don't know if the outcome will be regarded as free and fair, whether it will be destabilizing, whether it will provoke another round of instability. We don't have enough vaccine to do universal vaccine coverage, so we're staring at a very uncertain situation. There's no magic solutions. There's no clear pathway out from this, and it's highly dangerous and more complicated and more difficult in many respects than what we saw in West Africa in 2014-2015, which was, as you recall, awfully dangerous and frightening.
So what do you see as the best and worst case scenarios emerging at this time?
Well, a best case scenario would be we get through this election and things calm down, and the standard services and operations in trying to arrest the outbreak are able to be reinstituted at a more normal level, and the violence against providers and the overall general violence in the environment declines, and you could return to the vision that WHO has been advocating since the very beginning, which is this is going to be tough. We know it's going to be tough. It's going to take longer than we thought, but give us 6 months, 8 months, and we think we can finish the work. Another scenario is the violence does not abate. Targeted violence against health workers results in a decision by many of those to shut down operations or to convert to a whole different plan B. So far, there hasn't been a clear solution to addressing and arresting the threat posed by the Allied Democratic Forces. There's been some efforts made, only very partially successful, by the UN forces and by the Congolese forces to take them on, but ADF has proved very resilient and very able to strike back. Under a worst-case scenario, ADF comes roaring back and is highly disruptive, and that further aggravates an already very difficult security situation. Under a more positive scenario, the UN forces under their intervention brigade undertake a very forceful operation and are successful. The other is the community resistance. If there's no effective strategy undertaken to repair that problem in a more systematic and more deliberate way, you're blocked. You know, transmission will not be arrested, brought under control without the trust, cooperation, confidence of the communities.
So what role do you think that the whole political situation there has played?
That's the dominant story that preempts consideration of many other issues, and I think it's one that becomes the central preoccupation, and it colors the response on the Ebola outbreak in many ways. There's no appetite in Kinshasa for really giving top priority to the Ebola outbreak. If the government is thrown into disarray and we're not sure who's governing this country, that has grave complications for the leadership of the Ministry of Health and the leadership of the national laboratories. The last thing, of course, is that the East is very alienated politically from the coalition that runs this country. This problem is not going to go away. It's one that requires much higher leadership from the member states of the Security Council. It's going to require more leadership among the states, heads of state of Southern and Central Africa, who have a huge amount at stake here. Keep in mind, back in 1997-98, when DRC went into a full-blown, full implosion, in which you had somewhere in the 13 different armies on the soil of Congo in that period, and generated the death of estimated millions and displacement of millions. And it took years to bring things back together again.
That's Stephen Morrison, or J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, in partnership with the Uganda government, has intensified measures to prevent the spread of Ebola at the border with the DRC. This comes as groups of DRC nationals cross into Uganda. They're fleeing uncertainty about last Sunday's election, as we hear from Catherine Nambi in Kampala.
Wilson Agaba is the council chairperson of Isango sub-county in Uganda's Kasese district, where many Congolese refugees have pitched camp.
In fear of what is likely to be the outcome after the elections, people have decided to track into Uganda through various roads in Isango. Given the fact that the borders are porous, there are so many roads, so people come in at any time they wish.
Some DRC residents fear there may be violence after the vote results are announced in the coming days. The concern is that Congolese refugees present a risk that the Ebola virus will spread from the DRC to Uganda. For the past 4 months, the DRC has been battling a deadly Ebola outbreak in the North Kivu and Ituri provinces. More than 600 cases have been reported. Uganda already has a number of Ebola screening centers at official entry points at the border to prevent the spread of the hemorrhagic fever. However, these Congolese refugees are coming in through unofficial routes and are mingling with Ugandans without being screened for Ebola. Agaba says local authorities are asking community residents to identify any newcomers so that health teams can check them.
Whoever sees somebody coming through those routes, please, you should inform the authorities so that these people could be directed back and pass through the screening area.
The Ugandan army has been deployed at the border to ensure any DRC national are screened. Bright Ramirama is Uganda's defense minister.
Our troops are on the border and helping civilians who are running away from unrest in Congo. And as they do so, we prepare our medical teams to make sure that they screen these people, working with Ministry of Health, to make sure that transit routes and high-risk areas, especially where there is a concentration of refugees in the camps, are monitored very well.
The World Health Organization is vaccinating soldiers at the border to protect them from the Ebola virus. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is the WHO Director General, and he has been in Uganda over the past few days.
UPDF, of course, they were part of the vaccination, and some of their members were vaccinated. And based on the risks they face, we will continue to do that. Those who may have contacts and risks has to be vaccinated.
More than 100 Congolese are said to be camping in the areas of Kishororo, Kithoruhu, Isango, and Nyabugando, which neighbor the DRC. A temporary refugee camp has been established to host the Congolese as the world awaits the outcome of the DRC elections. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Finally, a U.S. dragnet appears to be closing around a major case of financial fraud in Mozambique. Four people, including a former finance minister, have been arrested for alleged crimes related to a $2 billion loan the nation took out secretly in 2013 and 2014. Disclosure of the loan in 2016 triggered a massive debt crisis in the Southern African nation. VOA's Anita Powell has the story for VOA from Johannesburg.
It sounds like a Hollywood caper. A group of London bankers, international investors, and government officials spun tales of state companies desperate for loans in a resource-rich nation trying to rebuild after a bruising civil war. Their tales netted loans of $2 billion, which quickly disappeared. Then this caper turns tragic. The government, not knowing it was $2 billion in debt, operated as usual until 2016, when the loan was discovered. The government defaulted, triggering an economic crisis. The currency tumbled, prices rose, and hospitals ran out of basic supplies. This isn't Hollywood. This, allegedly, is Mozambique, according to an indictment that has resulted in the arrests of at least four people now awaiting extradition to the United States for their role in defrauding U.S. investors. VOA obtained a redacted copy of the indictment issued by the U.S. District Court's Eastern District of New York. It accuses the four, plus another man who has not been arrested, and two others who were not named, of creating projects as facades to raise money to enrich and pay bribes to themselves, Mozambican officials, and others. Last week, Officials in South Africa arrested Mozambique's former finance minister, Manuel Chang, on an Interpol warrant. He faces possible extradition to the U.S. This, says analyst Alex Vines of the Chatham House Research Group, is a very big deal.
So it looked as if nothing would happen about these many millions, probably billions of U.S. dollars that were accounted for. So the indictment that has occurred from the U.S. District Court, Eastern District of New York, for key characters involved in this undisclosed loan scandal is very, very significant and is a game changer, I think.
That's certainly the case in Mozambique, where commentator Fernando Lima notes the public is largely applauding the arrests, while the ruling Frelimo party remains silent.
It caused this huge, huge embarrassment for the current government. Up to now, which is also very, very surprising, no Mozambican authorities have said anything related to the arrest of Mr. Chang. Neither the government, neither Frelimo party, neither the Attorney General office, or our parliament.
Vine says it's not clear how President Filipe Nyusi, who was defense minister at the time of the loans, will emerge from the scandal, but added there may be a bright side for investors who are eager to put money into the nation, which will start exporting natural gas in 2023.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, and bilateral donors to Mozambique had suspended lending to Mozambique, or direct government lending, should I say. They do want to move on. And so, again, I think this might help clear things up so that longer term, the relationship of Mozambique with some of its international creditors and international partners can be improved.
Rudy Krauss, the South African lawyer representing former Finance Minister Chang, says they'll fight the U.S. extradition request. Krauss said attorneys had not been given a full copy of the indictment by South African officials at the time of Chang's arrest, and so could not comment on the allegations. VOA was unable to reach Krauss after receiving the American copy of the indictment for further comment. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Fatina Yanini by Black Boogie. We've been listening to Black Boogie with the song Fatina Yanini. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. We're glad you could be here. Have a safe and peaceful weekend, and we hope that you can join us on Monday again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Kaso mi ajumungu atan kupanga maisha.